I think that the full impact of the tightening cycle has not yet been reflected in the economy. I think wheels are coming off in the private credit, private equity markets. The housing market is under strain, particularly in areas like Canada, where it was so exuberant during the free money era. I know that historically the worst recessions are triggered by downturns in housing. So I'm quite skeptical of how easily we will make our way out of this particular aggressive tightening cycle.
Hello and welcome back to SOAR Financially, where we discuss the macro to understand the micro. My name is Kai Hoffman. I'm the JR Mining Guy on Twitter and the CEO of the SOAR Financial Group. Really appreciate you joining us here for yet another interesting market discussion. Again, lots going on this week. My friend Trevor Hall called it the triple trouble. We got the Bank of Japan announced news this morning. We got the Fed or the FOMC meeting happening right now. And we got the Bank of England coming out on Thursday with a statement as well. And also, we're getting lots of other data dumped on us this week. Just this morning, Canadian inflation numbers came out. The housing start number came out in the U.S. as well. So lots and lots to discuss. And let's take a closer look at the economy. How are the markets doing? And I've invited a fantastic guest to discuss. She's a first-time guest as well, so I'm really excited to have her on. It's Danielle Park of Venable Park Investments. And I butchered that company name there, Danielle. It is Venable Park Investment Counsel, Inc., and I apologize for that. But I really appreciate you joining us. I'm really looking forward to our discussion.
Thanks, Kai.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, we've been, this is a long time in the making. And you were at VRIC a couple times. We saw each other briefly there, but now it's time. Let's get down to business here. Let's talk economy. Let's talk markets. And let's start with a general overview, Danielle. How confident are you feeling about the economy right now? How healthy is the market?
Well, how confident? I wish I could be extremely confident in my views. I find the more you understand about how things work, the less confident you are, which is sometimes the opposite of what other people think. But I would say that there is a difference between the economy and the stock market. They're not the same thing. And even if you have a relatively constructive outlook for the economy, for example, it doesn't mean that you're happy with stocks at any price, and valuations ultimately matter. So the price that people pay is, you know, the risk reflects the risk to capital. So I always try and, you know, I'm not a macroeconomist. I'm a financial analyst by training and a portfolio manager. I've been doing that work for over 25 years. And so our perspective is always about preserving principal and trying to navigate capital through without big drawdowns, because big drawdowns tend to be very harmful to individuals in their real life. Their reactions typically are very bad. They often jump out of moving vehicles, do things at the wrong time. So we're always fixated on trying to smooth the ride as much as possible, while still, you know, you have to take some risk unless you're entirely in cash. So it's always a question of relative risk reward at a particular time. And as I look at that today, I would have to say we've been in a holding pattern really for since at least 2021, where stock valuations became obscene and the speculative mania sentiment was off the charts. And it was really a function of a lot of money given out by governments during the pandemic, which made people feel richer than they had before. And also central banks, of course, with the most extreme easing cycle that we'd seen basically in 5,000 years. We had zero interest rates for many, many years. We had QE. We had the Bank of Japan buying, you know, equity ETFs on top of corporate debt, on top of every other central bank in the world buying assets and pumping cash into the financial institutions. And so all of that really unleashed this very euphoric attitude throughout the population. And it was really worldwide, and it was really across all asset classes pretty much. But it was short-lived, because as funds began to dry up in 2022, we saw that bubble of euphoria burst. And we had, of course, as you know, quite a significant drawdown in risk assets in 2022, as well as in the bond market. So really everything that had benefited from all the easing and easy money conditions into 2022, as central banks began tightening and doing so in the fastest cycle that we had seen since at least the 70s, as that happened, everything really took a hit and sold off. Now, if you fast forward to from, say, November of last year, we got again into this belief that central banks are going to rush to the rescue of the too tight conditions. This is the market's assessment right now, is that they're going to rush to the rescue, start easing as they did, for example, during the pandemic when they did such an abrupt face to rescue the world, backstop everything. So there's really a buy the dip mentality that's been definitely ingrained in the population, in institutions, in individuals. And so now we've got a very quick rebound in the last few months back to maximum bullish sentiment, speculative fever. We've seen it again across pretty much all the risk assets, whether it's the commodity, the currency, cryptocurrency space, equities, day trading options, you know, just the meme stocks. Everything is really back in full vigor. And that to me just screams of a double top, of the fact that valuations have got worse, not better. I haven't seen conditions this extreme since 2021, and before that, pretty much not since 2000. And 2007 was a pretty euphoric period, but this one really makes that look small in comparison. So I guess, you know, I think that the full impact of the tightening cycle has not yet been reflected in the economy. I think wheels are coming off in the private credit, private equity markets. The housing market is under strain, particularly in areas like Canada, where it was so exuberant during the free money era. I know that historically the worst recessions are triggered by downturns in housing. So I'm quite skeptical of how easily we will make our way out of this particular aggressive tightening cycle with, you know, real estate leading to the downside. I'm not convinced we're in a soft landing, although that has become the consensus view. I think it's too early to call that. I still think that there is a lot of reason to suspect we're going to have a harder landing that is present than presently priced in. And so I remain quite cautious at this point. When you get excessive valuations with excessive speculative fever and a downturn in the economy, it's typically a recipe for capital losses and widespread, not just in a few things.
Oh, fantastic, Danielle. I mean, I took so many notes, I'm not even sure how to summarize it. Fantastic overview. And of course, lots to follow up on. Let's try breaking that down a little bit. And maybe a very simple question to start with. How difficult is your job right now?
Oh, you know what? It's really difficult. I think there's a few reasons why being a fiduciary risk manager is very difficult. Mostly because you're operating in a world full of salespeople, sales side firms, which are their whole purpose is to create product and get it into client accounts, right? That's the majority of people that operate in the finance space. There's a whole other bunch of people that are promoters that don't even manage money for a living. They actually just write newsletters or do videos or discussions, have media companies, and they are also touted as experts in how to manage risk and financial assets. And they actually don't have any duty of care in anything that they're doing. So you're really, as I say, as a fiduciary manager who has a duty of care to put the best interests of the client first, we're absolute returns. So we're not just trying to track a benchmark. We're trying to avoid drawdowns. That makes that even more tricky since you're in this kind of really bubbly environment for so many things. So doing our job is really difficult. It's a 24/7. It's constant care. And the other thing is that individuals tend to be their worst enemy. So people tend to have a lot of impact from, as I say, sales side advertising and promotion, clickbait, talk at cocktail parties is usually about the one big stock someone won with and not anything about the losses. You know, case in point, you hear everyone, a lot of people today, well, bullish sentiment is as high as the 21. As I said, the share of bears is something less than 15%. Whenever you've seen that kind of really wide disparity in the amount of bulls versus bears, it's also typically a sign of a peak in a market cycle. But the fact is that we are still only back to where we were and still negative in many asset classes from the peak in 21. So in other words, if you think of it another way, everyone's talking about this, you know, new high in, for example, the S&P 500, which has been driven by a handful of tech stocks. It was the Mag 7. Now it's really the Mag 4 because, you know, some of the all-stars have slipped year to date. But basically, The small cap Russell 2000 is still negative since its peak in 21. The Canadian stock market has gone nowhere for 27 months. So again, you know, people are often distracted by the headlines without realizing that the average portfolio is still significantly negative from where the peak asset cycle was in the 2021 high. And people call that progress, you know. So it's all a question of framing. I find that we have very short attention spans today. We are, as I say, inundated with clicks and gambling mentality, right from casinos all the way to, you know, betting on everything there is. And the technology, the internet and the technology revolution that's come around financial-tainment, for the large part, has not done any favors to people because it distracts them and takes them away from the big picture risk management, you know, what they should be doing with their life savings, what risks they're exposed to, and really puts them all into how to gamble. And that's been a very, I think, destructive, but also I think we're going to see the full effect of that in the next phase when we get into the mean reversion period, because we have a bunch of baby boomers, for example, in the world, you know, currently in the sort of 60 to 76 age group, who are really have been increasingly taking on financial risk in the last few years during the low rate environment and this explosion of gambling obsession. And they have really lost the plot in terms of their own timeline. You know, the fact that they don't have, in many cases, 20 or 30 years for this to work out. You know, as we age, our timelines get shorter. Our risk tolerance gets shorter. You know, there's a lot of studies about the psychological and emotional impacts and costs of having big drawdowns and financial losses, particularly later in one's life. And I find that that is completely glossed over most of the time until you get a big shellacking event like a year like 2022 or 2008, when people are set back and it takes them years to recover, if they even have the wherewithal or the stomach to stick and hold things that have collapsed, you know, and do they have the time frame to wait for it all to come back? So these are the real life impacts that, you know, I think about and we try and be very cognizant of in the way we manage our clients' life savings. But I find that we're such a minority in a world of these other participants that very often have no skin in the game whatsoever. You know, if you blow up clients when you're a promoter or a sales firm or even a stockbroker, your liability is very, very limited. I mean, you will typically quickly go from calling yourself an advisor to calling yourself just a representative. That's what often happens. You know, clients come with complaints about losses and they say, well, we were just giving you product ideas. And here before that, people thought they were dealing with an advisor. So all of that really just makes doing the job well, with a longer term view and goal, very challenging.
Absolutely. No. And like maybe as a disclaimer as well, this is an infotainment channel, but we're trying to educate, of course, right? We're trying to give people an idea of what is happening in the markets. We're definitely not giving investment advice, far from it. But I'm trying to educate. That's the whole point. Discuss the macro to understand the micro, of course, right? What are your stocks doing that you're invested in, and what does the macro have to do with it? Right.
Yes.
Really, really important. And, you know, just like maybe expanding on that question a little bit as well. But and we'll drill down on some details, of course, Danielle, here as well. But like, where are you finding alpha these days? Like, where do you feel actually comfortable deploying, you know, said capital? Like you said, preserving principal. Where do you feel comfortable preserving that principal? Is it the bond market? I doubt it's real estate personally, but don't want to put words in my mouth. Curious where you're looking for alpha right now.
So the truth is that it's easier in some ways today than it has been since 2007. And that very base reason there is that the cash rate has gone from, you know, 0.25 3 years ago to 5% today. So people can actually afford to have things in guaranteed deposits and money market and cash that is actually yielding something today. Whereas, as I say, for more than a decade, it was yielding nothing. So it was so painful to try and keep any liquidity or cash on the sidelines when it was literally earning nothing sitting there. So today, you know, people can afford to have a significant portion of their portfolio in those liquid, whether it's treasuries or high interest savings or money market, these things that are, you know, with no equity risk exposure, for example, or corporate debt exposure, and they're yielding 5%. So that's a no-brainer, and we haven't had that, as I say, since 2007. So that's pretty extraordinary in terms of an opportune place to park capital while you wait for some of these other themes to unfold. The other thing that's much better today than it has been in years is the yield available on the safest credits. So the investment grade credits, the government credits, we have a good allocation to that. You know, again, those yields are, you know, around 4% today. You can lock in money for a fairly significant term around that. And 3 years ago, the best you could get in those credits was, you know, 1.5%, maybe 2%. So again, the incentive or case for holding the least market risk assets has been the strongest in the last, you know, year that it has been in many years before that. And the point is that those things actually match the risk tolerance and comfort of many people, especially those that have accumulated the bulk of their life savings, who are already in retirement. As I say, this cohort that owns the bulk of financial assets are actually over 60 today. You know, 20 years ago, they were just in their kind of midlife years. Now they're very much in the risk-averse stage, whether they appreciate that or not. You know, unfortunately, as I say, these conditions have really engendered this apathy or sense of, you know, risk tolerance among people that really don't have it. They just, it's kind of a mirage. They think they have it until they see big drawdowns, and then they tend to panic. So those two areas are the best I've seen in many years. Some of the dividend paying stuff has definitely come off of its peak. So we're starting to be more constructive in that area. The concern that I have there, of course, is that in the, you know, in the type of market environment that I'm discussing, where there's so much leverage on leverage and debt financed assets in whether it's real estate, credit markets, equity markets, all of this, you've got a terrible contagion implication here. When you do see, you know, the big drawdowns begin or sell-offs happen, it tends to spread like a wildfire. And so even though I'm more constructive on dividend paying stuff and we're waiting patiently for some more mean reversion in that area, and by the way, that typically happens once central banks start cutting rates. That's when the bulk of the down cycle typically happens, especially if you're heading into recession. So just that caveat to people, we haven't even yet got to the cutting phase of the cycle and people are already declaring the all clear, you know, everything's great. I would beg to differ with that. I don't think that there's much evidence to support that take from this. So we're definitely interested in buying more of the income producing dividend paying issues, because that is where compound gains come from over time. It's the reinvestment of income that drives the bulk of investment returns over time. People have misunderstood this again in the low rate environment. They think it's about winning, about capital gain, you know, about betting on something that's going to jump quickly. The problem with that is there's a lot of luck and mania involved in those type of allocations and decisions. And they typically don't work out over the longer term. And the less income that's being thrown off of something, the less reinvestment and compound return there actually is to have. So those things are, I guess, what I would look at as the most constructive opportunities today. And I am quite optimistic about some of the new technologies that are coming along to improve efficiency, to help with the aging population, you know, the energy revolution that's afoot right now. There's incredible opportunities in the making in terms of improving productivity and efficiency in the economy. But those are also the things that tend to be priced beyond any kind of reasonable valuation at the moment because they've been caught up in this euphoria. And so it, just because I'm constructive or interested in those longer term doesn't mean that right now I'm very attracted by the valuations on offer.
No, fantastic. Awesome. Danielle, I think we need to try forecasting a little bit, but one more market, like let's call it a market understanding question is like, where's the liquidity coming from? You were talking about unprecedented, you know, time of tightening. But then again, we're pretty much in an all asset bubble. It feels like, as you said, you Bitcoin, gold, the S&P 500, the main markets are all rallying, all near all-time highs. Let's help me understand, like, where is that liquidity coming from that is pushing these markets higher?
So it's been a function, almost a self-fulfilling circle in a way, in one sense, Kai, because as central banks have been tightening, they reignited the animal spirits in the fall of 23, so last fall, and that reignition of animal spirits and bidding up of financial assets has really been the equivalent of about 1.5% of loosening, because, you know, again, credit, junk debt, all that has rallied again in price as everyone's become apathetic about risk and who cares, it's all going to be great. So they've been buying things up such that the high yield credit spread relative to the most guaranteed paper out there, the treasuries, has come in under 400 basis points again. We're in 300 and change as in terms of the yield spread. And that again has been indicative repeatedly throughout time of a bad financial decision overpaying for an asset that has actually got a fairly significant default risk to it, and that's not priced in at all in these conditions. So the same goes for equities. As equities rise, you know, that is a form of financing available to corporations. And so when their stocks are at all-time highs, they do things like buy back their own shares, which again, self-fulfilling circle. They buy other companies, typically merge with each other with their shares as funny money currency when it's at its all-time highs. Those are the decisions that corporate executives make. Of course, they've got to look at where do we get capital the cheapest. Well, if the public markets are giving it to them, so be it. The banking system is currently not giving cheap money, right? Because it's based on the overnight rate, the tightening that has gone on. So bank credit has contracted significantly. That's money to the real economy. That's the small businesses, the households, the people that consume. Those people have seen a significant tightening of credit. But in terms of the publicly traded assets, they're banking on, as I say, this big surge in animal spirits, which is really loosened and provide liquidity. So it's a self-fulfilling circle in itself. Now, it also does it the opposite way, Kai, as you've seen many times, I'm sure, is that once that sort of sentiment goes the other way, everything starts falling together, and that also has a significant contraction on financial conditions, and that impacts all the publicly traded companies, which ultimately impacts everyone else as well. So that is part of what's been going on. The other part of it, of course, is the fiscal stimulus, especially in the United States coming into the election in the fall, has been like wartime style, at least, you know, even up to a few months ago, just with the different acts that were passed, and the funds that have been funneled in from debt financing has really been extraordinary. So the U.S. has really been kind of unique in that we haven't seen that level of stimulus in any other country. And now that said, of course, the Bank of Japan, as you know, Kai, just reversed from its, you know, for the first time in 17 years, they increased interest rates. And they went from a zero rate policy, which they had for many years, where you were literally paid to borrow money, not borrowers paying. How obscene and crazy a world is this? But they are now they're still fairly dovish. They're not in planning to raise rates a lot from here, but they have come off this extraordinary easy money condition that they held for so long. So that's been part of the puzzle as well. And as I say, they were buying equity ETFs as well to boost their own stock prices. So you've really got this kind of Ponzi scheme approach, quite honestly, where it's central banks as well as big corporations using the money that they can, that's, you know, and that's why they are always bullish and talking their book and trying to get the animal spirits going, because at some point, and this is what happens, Kai, everyone who is going to buy has bought, and you run out of greater fools. And at that point, then you have nothing but sellers. And that's what tends to throw the gasoline on the fire to the downside, right? And the more leverage that you see, the more debt people have, the more debt companies have, the less resilience they have to tolerate a decline in asset prices. And that also sparks a forced sale on the asset side, which helps to drive prices lower. So it's all like a big burst of optimism and wonder on the way up, but those are the same conditions that revert to this depression typically in the end on the way down. And as you alluded to, we have that now in real estate, not just in financial markets. So this makes me kind of extra concerned about the gravity of this particular cycle.
Danielle, I've got so many questions to follow up on. And you mentioned the soft landing scenario, and you're saying it's a bit too early to still even predict that. You mentioned like the only 15% of the market sentiment is bearish right now as well. It seems like I always find the bears to interview as well. I need to find a bullish investor. But maybe it's because I'm German and we always look for the negatives as well. But like one question that popped in my head is like, are we maybe able, or is the US actually able to maybe get away with one here? Like meaning that all the incentives, all the acts you've mentioned, $2.6 billion that were loaned to like Lithium Americas, like all that money that is flowing into the US economy, is that actually, might that be enough to smooth things over? And as I said, like maybe a bit lax, but get away with it?
Well, they've gotten away with it. I would certainly say they've extended this cycle longer because of all of these interventions. There's no question about that. If you even back up further, I would say that the recession, the US recession and the Canadian recession, we tend to be tied at the hip, was really in that direction or in the works in 2019. I think the cycle had very much topped out. Then we got the pandemic, and of course, all hell broke loose for a few months there. And then you got all the stimulus, both on the monetary and fiscal side, pumping in all over the world, which really elevated or extended, prevented, let's say, the sort of weight of the economic cycle from continuing to the downside, as I think that it would have naturally in 2020. So they kicked that can, they extended it further into 2022. Then, of course, you know, as they're trying to normalize interest rate policy, as they're trying to end that idea of the Fed put, so to speak, you know, then you get the big sell-off in all financial assets. And then you see the fiscal stuff really kick in, right? Trying to get into that last year of the presidential cycle and get things looking more rosy. And so there was a ton of money, especially in the American economy, thrown at everything. And that really did extend that cycle. So I think the soft landing has been already the last year. Now, if you look at the things that matter, you know, you've still got industrial production contracting, notwithstanding this extraordinary amount of fiscal deficits and funds that have been thrown at it. You've got industrial production contracting. You've got retail sales contracting at an annualized rate. So those are the two largest parts of the economy, right? The business investment side and the household services, household consumption. You've got the jobless rate, you know, has ticked up. As you know, Kai, it's more than a 0.5% increase from the all-time low in the unemployment rate in the United States and in Canada even more. So we have been losing jobs even as these ultra easy conditions have persisted longer than many had hoped or expected. And so you've got a downturn, you've got a bifurcation of the economy where a few people with, you know, some of these really high flying assets have got very uber optimistic again, but you have a lot of the population that's struggling. And this is increasing as we know, because as debts come up for refinancing, and they are doing so, you know, in Canada, about 20% of mortgages are coming up each year here. And the interest rates that they're being replaced at are two times and more higher than what the previous debt was taken out at. And that's, you know, in the United States, they're back to near 7% interest rates as the bond market has sold off a bit, you know, repricing the idea of how many rate cuts we're going to get. So you've got these forces that are really, as I say, bank credit contracting. So if under the hood, the only things that have really held up longer were the unemployment rate has, you know, fared fairly well longer in this cycle, even as the Fed was hiking. However, I would point out that that's very typical. The unemployment rate is typically a lagging indicator, and that rises through the first year of a recession and beyond. Even when you get into the recovery phase, you tend to see the unemployment rate rise. So the fact that it is held in longer is pretty typical. The fact that the stock market has, you know, been in a world of its own dreaming is, again, pretty typical when you get a lot of liquidity and bullish sentiment and gambling mentality and a lot of young people feeling like they have no chance of having an income that will pay for their life. And so they might as well double down on gambling. Right. So this is worth this day trading of options and all the exuberance we've seen. And then I think the crypto space, again, it's interesting. Right. In the 2021 melt up, you saw a lot of retail traders and mania around the crypto space. But in the last few months, you've seen the mania around institutional buying. So if you think about this, this goes back to a pet peeve I've had in for some time, which is that Wall Street loves to package and present products at the peak of cycles to stoke, you know, supposedly to help the little person, Kai, to help the little person have access to these sophisticated instruments, right? This is what they're always telling us. So we've seen that in the last few years with the private debt, private equity market. So as rates were at nearly zero for 13 years and people couldn't make a decent yield on conventional instruments that were in line with their risk profile, they were increasingly looking to more esoteric, you know, so-called sophisticated instruments. And the retail, you know, sales side rushed to the opportunity there and packaged a bunch of this illiquid instruments, whether it's, you know, as I say, private debt, private mortgages, private properties, packaged them all into fancy wrappers and sold them to the public as if they were liquid. Meanwhile, inside, it's very illiquid. And as they concentrated and more firms brought out these products, they were all holding essentially the same things. Well, fast forward to the last year when the credit crunch is spreading, there's rising defaults and delinquencies. People are having a hard time making their payments. You're seeing them look for cash in all kinds of places and ask for redemption. So what have these products done? They have frozen redemptions because they can't possibly give back the cash because they don't have the cash, right? It was all put into these illiquid instruments. And so today we know that the average fund manager has about 3% cash, and there's less than 6% or 4%, I think, at this point, allocation to investment grade credits. And everything else is all these really, you know, heavily concentrated, interconnected, illiquid, because everybody's holding them already. Again, once everybody's bought, who's going to buy? Who's going to sell is the question, because now when you blink and you need money, everyone's looking to sell the same thing. So we saw that with spades. And then we saw the pensions all sort of reaching for these products as well, and this exposure and increasing. And now they're starting to book losses because they also are having trouble. You know, they're very opaque. They can't get market pricing. They try and take their money back and they can't get it. It's gated. So this has happened on all that. And there's story after story. I write about it on my blog fairly often because it just keeps coming week after week. And people are learning the hard way that you can't just buy these products and pretend like they're liquid when what's inside is really what matters. The same thing has happened now with the crypto space, where institutions kept lobbying the regulators to get approval to make these retail packaging of this really highly speculative, high risk asset class. And they're putting it into packaging and Vanguard and, you know, Purpose and all these places that sell themselves as, you know, investment product companies are now marketing and taking in tons of cash from the retail side into these products. And I think that's going to end badly. But in the meantime, it has definitely driven up the price again of these illiquid things.
It's so much like to digest here, Danielle. It's insane. Like, again, I think I got like 3 pages of notes, and I know we won't get to all of it. But I want to discuss with you a little bit as well. Like, how is this going to play out? Right? Like, we all know, like, it can't go on forever, but it seemingly does. You brought up Japan earlier, and like, until recently, I kept asking all my guests, like, is the U.S. going the way of Japan? Are they going to sacrifice the U.S. dollar for the greater good, where the Treasury starts buying, like, ETFs to support the market and to support the system, and the debt-to-GDP ratio is just exploding, right? It's just a scenario. Like, I don't see it happening, because I think having the U.S. dollar as a world reserve currency is a bit of a different factor than the yen, potentially. But the same question, like, how do you see this playing out? Like, what is the end game here? Like, we see the cheap money. We see the U.S. debt, for example, exploding, $34.5 trillion. Debt service payments over $1 trillion a year. Doesn't sound very sustainable, yet here we are. We're talking about it. And I just asked you the previous question. Did we get away with it? Like, are we getting away with it, right? So, what is the endgame scenario there, Danielle?
Well, the DXY has actually been rising significantly. It's breaking out this morning, of course. The Japanese yen is weakening because they're, you know, not promising to rise, to keep rates higher for longer now. They've sort of said, you know, we're coming off of this negative rate policy, but we don't expect to do a lot of hiking going forward. So the yen is weakening against the dollar, and the dollar has been rising against commodity-based currencies like the Aussie, the New Zealand dollar, the Canadian dollar. And so we are always looking for opportunity for capital gain on the US dollar side relative to the Canadian dollar being Canadian-based managers. So there is opportunity there. And again, when you get into the sell side portion, the capitulation, the need cash and everybody looking to take out money at the same time, you typically see a rise in the US dollar in the currency, because especially if people are trying to pay down debt, because a lot of the world debt is actually denominated in US dollars. So as interest rates have risen and as the amount of debt outstanding in emerging and developing countries has been taken out in US dollar, they need more and more of it to meet their commitments. So that tends to be a support under the US dollar, which typically leads to a sell-off again in some of these other riskier assets. So in the short term, I don't think that the US dollar is the main concern. I am worried about the next 4 years because, frankly, there's no conservative government options anymore, it seems. They're all very conservative. They're getting increasingly conservative on social issues, but nothing about fiscal issues, it seems to me. I think that's because they are mostly bought and paid for these days by corporations. We could get into all that. The rule of law has really been suppressed. And we've got, you know, these public companies really calling the shots. We've got insiders in government day trading, you know, doing everything that's in their own interest, but not in the longer term interest of the policy in the country they're trying to lead. So there's a lot of that going on. But in terms of an end game, it has been a very challenging time mentally to be someone who takes measurements and is aware of historical precedents, because a lot of people, as I've expressed, are not in that business, that are in the finance sector. They are not looking out for what can go wrong. They are only looking out for how to sell things to people, how to get everyone in, you know, how to be uber bullish. That is the stock and trade of the balance or most of the participants. So as someone who's looking out for what can go wrong and trying to protect principal, trying to protect clients, it's a very mentally challenging period to go through this extended, as I say, 27 months of going nowhere and people calling it progress, as we've had this rebound in risk assets from 2022. I would just say that unless this time is different, Kai, okay, it might be different. Unless this time is different, human behavior has never been, has always been the same throughout centuries of behavior. And that is that when you get everyone, as I say, everyone that can buy, everyone that can lever, everyone that's borrowed the last dime that they can support with their income or their government handouts, when you get to the end of that, you get to the end of people who can put new capital in, and then you typically start seeing people trying to take capital out. We're seeing that now. As I said, in some of these illiquid, more illiquid areas, you're seeing not just individuals, retail people, but institutions, right? The BlackRocks of the world are defaulting. They're walking away from buildings. You know, we've got the commercial real estate debacle, which, yes, impacts the regional bank significantly, but let's not kid ourselves. It is also a significant portion of the loan book at major banks. And so, you know, the financial institutions are, they are the benefactors of all the exuberance and free money and, you know, credit orgy on the way up, but they also take hits on the way down. And we're starting to see that with setting aside greater and greater loan loss provisions. And, you know, we're having a lot to be concerned about. Well, not just, you know, with, again, the smaller banks, but the credit balances outstanding. Here's an example. The credit cards in the United States, some of the major cards, we've seen them, you know, leap. The share prices leap 30 and 40% in the last year as the consumer credit balances have reached all-time highs. So if you think about that, okay, so we're saying that's great for the credit companies who are giving out the debt, who are charging more than 20% on, you know, more than $1 trillion now of consumer debt. I'm talking about the US, but similar patterns have happened in Canada. But at the same time, we're realizing that the delinquency rates, the defaults are spiking to levels we have not seen since 2008 in these exact companies. So, you know, if 10% of the loans are defaulting, then they're too going to have to confront bad debts, bad loans, set aside reserves for money that won't be collected. And how is that reflected in the stock prices? The answer is it's not, right? So this gets to the point, at some point, the math actually matters. And what was euphoric on the way up becomes depressive on the way down. And that is when the people with the resolve and discipline and not losing their minds in the mania of the crowds, who can maintain some liquidity, who have more than 3% cash. And don't forget that most money managers have every incentive in the world to get that cash in the market as soon as you give it to them. They're not in the business of holding on to liquidity for the client. They're not even paid in most cases to hold liquidity. They're paid to get things fully invested. So if you're moving advisors today, and you're thinking you're going to get into a different market by going to a different advisor, they're going to put you back in the exact same products and sectors, maybe in different wrappers, calling them different names, but there is only one marketplace. And so if everything is overvalued in stocks globally, and there's certainly worse in the United States than other areas, but there has been a manic infection in many of the markets at the same time, and the dash for cash provokes the selling in all the markets at the same time. So I guess, you know, how do I see this playing out? I still am in the camp that history will be consistent at some point here. It has been a great test of resolve, but for those who can withstand the constant barrage of the bullish mania, there's going to be an opportunity here, as there was last most significantly in 2008-09. That's the last time. You know, in 2020, we saw the collapse of markets within a matter of weeks, 3 weeks, things plunged, and then there was a quick V. That's also part of what has programmed current participants to think that a bear market is something that, you know, happens in a matter of weeks and then rebounds sharply. And that historically has not been the pattern. So again, I would caution people to not take the recent experience of just the last few months, or indeed what happened in 2020, and think that they, you know, are confident in how this is going to play out, because those would be very anomalous periods.
No, absolutely. Definitely unprecedented times that we're in here. Absolutely. There's definitely going to be books written about this current period. Looking back, it'll be really interesting to analyze what has been going on and how is it possible that, as you say, four stocks can really move a market like this. Right. That's what we're seeing.
The 30% concentration in the mega top handful is something that's only been seen once before in 2000 and before that in 1929. So if you don't know your market history, you maybe don't know the significance of those. But those were two of the highest tops in stocks in the last 100 years, after which they fell for many years and took 15 plus 25 years in the case of 29 to recover the prior peak. So that is the precedent that we're dealing with today. But yes, maybe this time is different.
I love that saying. Maybe it's different, or this time is different. You know. So maybe last question, summary question. I mentioned to you before we hit the record button that I'm going to ask that as my summary question, and you need to help me weather the bear market here that is coming, of course, Danielle. And if I were to come to you with $1 million right now and say, please invest this for me, preserve, or based on your assessment of the market, like how would you allocate capital right now? And again, audience, please understand this is not investment advice. I'm just trying to see where Danielle's mindset is and also trying to understand, of course, this is where the market is going, where are some opportunities, where can we generate a bit of alpha, but also maybe preserve capital if, you know, poo-poo hits the fan, of course. So Danielle, sure. Curious your thoughts.
So again, given my role and training and job and that I've described, the first thing I would be asking is, do you have any debt? Do you have debt outstanding? Because you should be paying off your debt before you should be putting anything in market assets. That's the first thing, which is probably 3% of the financial managers in the world would ever say that, because it does mean that people pay off debt instead of giving you assets. But that is the best answer. That is the truthful answer.
Can I ask, so if it's mortgage debt, would you recommend to pay that off first? And in Germany, yes. By the way, for example, I have a 10-year mortgage. It's a bit different than the US or Canada in that regard. It's
sure.
A different market.
So I would definitely pay off first the high interest rate consumer credit cards, lines of credit, student loans, any of that stuff. Try and get that off the books. Try not to finance your cars. Try and buy used cars so that you don't have payments of any kind. And then next, working on your shelter, I would focus on getting your mortgage off, because the safety and resiliency of having your home paid for is huge. Also, it allows you to save more for retirement. As soon as you don't have monthly payments going out, you have ability to save monthly, which is very constructive to overall financial health over time. So I think that's really important. But assuming a person has no debt outstanding, the next question I would have is, what country do they live in? What country do they pay their bills in? Because if they're American, that's one thing in terms of how much American dollar exposure you want to have in your portfolio. But if you're a European, and you pay the bulk of your debts in euros, then you don't want to have the bulk of your financial portfolio in another currency. It's important to match your liabilities with your assets to some extent. So I would definitely want to look at that. The other factor would be their age, their time horizon, what portion of their net worth this $1 million is. But assuming, say, for example, they're debt-free, they're 50 years old and they have $1 million in savings, and I would then look at, say they're American-based, for example, then you would have perhaps 70% of the money kept in US dollars, perhaps 30% could be in other currencies, if you have other assets that you want to purchase in those currencies. But essentially, I would look at keeping it in treasuries at this point, in some of the fixed-term bonds, because as I say, the yields are the highest they've been in many years. So if we're right about, if the central banks, and they are all talking about, they will be cutting at some point now, whether they start by June, whether they start by January of next year, the point is they expect to be in an easing cycle at some point in the next year, in which case the current rates on offer on the short stuff will decline, right, as soon as they start cutting. And so having some money locked in a little bit longer is good. The other piece is, a lot of people like to have things like gold bullion, silver bullion as some kind of an alternate store of value. And in which case, I like that to be done with physical representation, not securitized versions, not ETFs or, the paper funds that purport to have backing by these assets. I would suggest that people, they can have maybe 10% of their net worth in some of those hard assets if they see that as something that's more of a diversification and safety place that makes them feel better if all hell breaks loose and everything else. But I would keep a good portion of it in, as I say, in the short-term cash portion. Like, if the world is short on cash, and it is, they're long assets and very short on cash today. So as a contrarian and someone who's wanting to have the opportunity on the other side of this, which is going to be, by the way, probably as extraordinary as it was in 2002-03, in 2009, it wasn't even as good in 2008-09 because we had a big drawdown, but it didn't get valuations back to as cheap as they were, for example, in 1988-2, where it was an extraordinary opportunity to put money into the equity markets and that sort of thing. So also real estate, I agree with you. It is quite overvalued, both in Europe, in Canada, extraordinarily so, relative to household incomes, relative to rents. So it is not somewhere where I'd be putting new investment dollars per se, unless there's a case-by-case scenario where, a particular building just happens to be extremely undervalued and you can see, generating income from it by renting it for significantly more than, so the net income ratio is very high. I'm not saying there aren't opportunities like that, but they're not a dime. There's not a lot of them right now because of this general overinflation in real estate assets. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't, keep your house. I see people trying to trade their houses sometimes. I've met people like this over the years where, they say, well, I sold my house 3 years ago and we've been renting since because we thought it was overvalued. And I was like, well, did you dislike your house? Did you not want to be there for the long run? Oh, no, it was great, but we just felt it was overvalued. Well, that gets to be pretty precarious. I don't like this mentality of trading everything that you own as a speculative move here and there. I think having a home that you can enjoy with your family and that is paid for is an excellent goal. And if you're looking to buy one even today because your lifeline suggests that you need to get settled and get a house, then I just say buy one you can afford with the maximum down payment that allows you to pay it off, even at current rates, where you can see that it's not, say, more than 4 times your household income, where you're not paying, say, more than 30% of your disposable income on your shelter. Those basic long-term rules will do you extraordinarily well over time. They've been tried and true through decades and decades of experience. So it is always a case of looking at the individual facts and circumstances, the individual prices relative to incomes and rents, and trying to figure out where actual investment opportunity is rather than just where the masses are throwing things around and gambling, because that always ends up being a disaster. So it's that strength to withstand the lure of easy money and keep your wits about you in terms of actual investment principles and work that you do. And then making your buy list. I mean, I think that there's going to be, I'm actually a big fan of the whole renewable energy trends that are unfolding around the world. I've been driving an electric car for many years. I think this is the way of the world. I think there are certain commodities that will be in high demand in that cycle. There's a caveat there that the innovation of technology is allowing a lot of substitution that people didn't think would be possible, you know, whether it's subbing lithium for magnesium or sodium or all different battery technology that can unfold really quickly. And that's hard for some people to foresee because it's literally a function of, you know, computing power and innovation and breakthroughs and who knows when these happen. So you have to be very careful that you don't only, you know, throw all your money into something that was the go-to, you know, 5 years ago or 2 years ago, even today. So it gets quite complicated. But I generally speaking think there's going to be some great opportunity on that side of the things. The miners and producers have been beaten up since 2008, really. They rallied into 11. They've been really not popular. They've been suffering for cash, let's put it that way, as all these other large cap manias have really sucked the money and the private debt and equity and all that sort of thing. So I think there's going to be opportunity in the parts of the economy that make things that are not just ethereal, you know, bubble stuff, but actually make things and help us with this transition to a renewable energy economy and to all the new tech that's coming out. But again, for an individual, they tend to be very volatile, long-term, you know, 10 to 20 year plays. And not a lot of people have that kind of timeline and or appetite for sticking through, you know, holding on things that flop around like crazy and don't ultimately go up for a period of years. In my experience, most individuals don't have the stomach for that, and they'll tend to bail out and miss the opportunity. So it's an area where I see there becoming, you know, opportunity in the future. But I am worried that, you know, you're going to see, as I say, forced selling across the board here. So that doesn't mean that just because you have a macro thesis that something will be in demand in the future doesn't mean that those companies or producers or products will not be vulnerable when the mania starts to come out of this particular cycle again.
No, fantastic. Danielle, last 30 seconds, your camera froze, but we heard you perfectly. So,
oh, sorry about that.
Just the last 30 seconds. So, because I noticed you were coming to the end, that's why I didn't want to interrupt, but you froze. It was a fantastic summary at the end. Really, really appreciate your time. That was a fantastic discussion, Danielle. Really appreciate it. Fantastic insights. Oh, there she is again.
Sorry, I don't know what happened.
Oh, I'm assuming, like, because we've been chatting for over an hour now, that maybe there's an hour time limit or so on the screen or
okay.
Something.
Okay, all right.
I'm assuming that was the case, but you're back.
Okay.
But no, fantastic discussion. Again, like, there's so much we can still touch on, of course. Like, we haven't really even talked about the commercial real estate crisis that is looming, that could set the whole thing in motion pretty much, right? We're going to do that in part two at some point, Danielle. But where can we find more of your work? It's been fantastic.
Oh, I'm on Twitter at K Danielle Park, and I'm on jugglingdynamite.com is my daily website blog that I write and direct people to clips and articles and everything that I think is relevant to what's going on. And our firm website is venablepark.com.
Fantastic. Awesome. Danielle, thank you so much for your time. It was really, really insightful. Definitely have to have you back for part two. And we didn't even get to touch on the Canadian inflation signal that we got this morning, because that could be interesting, because are we going to see more cheap and free money in Canada? Because Canada has a bit of a track record the last few years of giving out free money. So, and we haven't talked about the CERB program, which I'm really personally nagged on about, because I repaid my CERB. And didn't know it was going to turn into a 5% loan or something, a cheap money. So that's a different topic. That's a sore topic.
Yeah. So. Well, Canada's economy is definitely weaker than the US, and our bond yields reflect that. Our 10-year is already like 3.5 relative.
Danielle, now I lost you.
Oh, okay.
Okay, it froze. All right. It froze.
We better go.
Okay. Okay. No, the computer says no. Computer says we're done. Danielle, really appreciate your time. And again, thanks so much for coming on, and to everybody else. Thank you so much for tuning in. Really appreciate you watching our channel and getting educated. Again, none of this is investment advice. We're trying to educate you. We're trying to understand, where is the market going? Why is it moving in a direction that it is going right now? And of course, there's so much weighing on the markets right now as well. If you follow social media, you can't escape, you know, like, you're being hammered daily with news, so many data points being dropped on you. Cut out the noise, hire a financial expert, hire somebody like Danielle. I think that's her job, to educate, to be educated, and then educate you and help you through this, like, nightmare. I think it's a nightmare. Yes, there's some easy investment solutions, but I think as a retail investor, it is a nightmare out there, because you don't know what to listen to and where the noise is taking things. So use professional help. Follow our channel, of course. Hit that subscribe button. Hit that like button as well. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know how you feel about our guests. Like, are we asking the right questions? We do want to hear from you, because that makes the program better and we can improve as well. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll be back with lots more. Thank you.